When I was a young child, I was a member of the Episcopal Church, and one Sunday every year, the children were in charge of the service. And I remember one year, my older sister was going to give the homily, which is the sermon in the Episcopal Church. And I remember she began like this: "From ghoulies and ghosties and long-leggedy beasties and things that go bump in the night, good Lord, deliver us." And I think that's what we're saying here today. God, deliver us from things that we aren't aware of, from things that come at us that are bad, that are evil, that are hurtful. And help us stand firm in you. Help us to remain in you.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
It seems like in life and in trying to understand things, I take some pretty big swings. One of the swings that I've taken is in the area of spiritual warfare. This is our last in the series on spiritual warfare. And I think where I came from real early in my life was I thought spiritual warfare was kind of like Satan's going to come out of the closet in any moment, and I needed to be kind of watching my backside because maybe I was going to get hit from behind. I've gone from that kind of scared position to a real swing of saying, "Ah, that's ridiculous, Christine," and kind of poo-pooing it and setting it aside, I think mainly because I didn't understand it and didn't take the time to deal with it. But it seems like we have been coming to a middle-of-the-ground kind of understanding of spiritual warfare, and I think it's really helpful and it's really grounding to me to understand it. Jack, as a way of introducing our last series, can you just briefly again summarize a definition of what is spiritual warfare?
Spiritual warfare is the battle that all of us have to fight for holding on to, hanging on to our faith, believing that it's true, believing that the values that are implicit in what Jesus and the apostles taught are the real, objectively real, valuable things in our existence, and believing that and hanging on to that and living our life in the light of that. Something that is a very difficult thing to do, not an easy thing to do. And our warfare is to stay the path, continue believing, continue living in the light of the truth of the gospel, rather than being led astray by seductive ideas that would get us to look at life differently in a way that is false and based on lies rather than based on the truth. So I think the reason you described it as middle of the road is, on the one hand, we really do live a dangerous and treacherous life. Most of us are going to crash and burn, where most of us are not going to make it, because we're going to believe those lies and we're going to base our lives on those lies, on the one hand. On the other hand, the sort of danger that we're in is in our control, in the sense that it's our choice to make. We can decide whether or not we're going to hold on to the truth or not. It's not like we're going to get clubbed in the back of the head by Satan, the burglar that didn't know was there. It's not that kind of uncontrolled situation that we need to fear. It's a situation that is in reach. It's in control of our will. But we have to recognize how clever the lies are that we're up against and combat them and on our guard.
How clever they are, Jack, in the sense that they're every day.
Mm-hmm.
We encounter them in the relationships that we have all the time, in the situations in our lives all the time, in the struggles in our lives all the time. And that's why we've been looking at this series through Jesus' crucifixion on the cross and the whole trial that led up to it, because those are everyday people who are making decisions and kind of showed their humanness. These are people who didn't remain in the faith. These were people who didn't abide in the faith. And I think that's a really big piece. There's a section in Acts that talks about abiding in the faith, which I think you explained to us at one point was we need to remain in. We need to stay in the faith.
Right.
And that's a really big issue for us. There's a lot of passages that talk about us easily being taken away from the truth of the gospel.
Right, exactly. And that is warfare. That's the spiritual warfare that the Bible talks about.
Okay. So would you like to comment on that passage in Acts at all, where it talks about abiding in him? Because I think that's something that we really, really get lost. Can we do that real quickly?
Sure. Mm-hmm. There are a number of passages we could go to. This just happens to be one that I've been teaching through recently, where Barnabas is in Antioch just before he goes up to Tarsus to get Paul and bring Paul back down to Antioch, and they spend a year teaching together in Antioch. But before he goes and gets Paul, he's there alone, and it says of Barnabas, when he arrived in Antioch...
Now, where are we? We're in Acts 11?
I'm chapter 11 of Acts in verse 23. Then when he arrived and witnessed the grace of God, he rejoiced and began to encourage them all with resolute heart to remain true to the Lord. That's how my New American Standard Bible translates it, but it's literally the word that often gets translated abide, to abide in the Lord. I know as a younger Bible teacher, I was taught, particularly out of John 15, abide in Christ and he will abide in you, just as the vine must abide in the, just as the branch must abide in the vine, so you must abide in Christ, that whole passage about vines and branches abiding. And I was taught that abiding was a kind of spiritual consciousness, a state of consciousness spiritually, where we were allowing the juices of the vine, namely the juices of the Spirit of God, to flow through us and give us life. And so it was a spiritual technique, if you will. It was a state of consciousness that I arrived at that kind of unleashed in my existence all the power of God through His Spirit. So it would be the power to combat temptation, the power to have victory over sin, the power to evangelize, the power to be successful in whatever endeavor in life I was concerned about. I could have divine resources to make me able to do whatever I set out to do. But I would only have those resources if I would abide, they called it. And this translation here in the New American Standard, to remain true to the Lord, is a much better translation. It captures much better what I think that word always means in Jesus and the Apostles' teaching, and that is to persevere in our faith, persevere in believing the truth of the gospel. Don't go believe something else. Don't begin believing some of the lies that you're going to hear, but accept that the truth is the truth and make that the focal point and the defining belief of your life, to make that in the long haul, to persist in that. That's to abide.
Okay, so let's look at the chief priests and how they dealt with Jesus in the account in the Gospels.
Okay.
And I think what we're going to do there, Jack, is see how the situation around Jesus' crucifixion brought out some parts of their character that showed that they really were not remaining true to the Lord. They were not remaining true to their faith at all. And thus, that's a way in which they lost in their battle, in the spiritual warfare battle.
We've looked at Herod, who just had a hard heart. I mean, the truth wasn't even interesting or intriguing to him. We've looked at Pilate, who was torn. I mean, you really see Pilate wavering. He really doesn't want to to crucify Jesus because he really doesn't think it's justified. And it's not like he's a really particularly just man. Nothing in his history has suggested that he's a particularly just man on the one hand. On the other hand, it's such an outrageous injustice that he doesn't see why he should do that. But in the end, he finally capitulates and says, well, okay, crucify him. It's your deal. I'm going to have nothing to do with it. But we see his moral impurity. He's quite willing to sacrifice what is right for the sake of what is expedient or convenient to him.
And wasn't it also, Jack, that it was more than convenient for him? He was concerned about their threat to take away some of his power by reporting him to
To Caesar.
To Caesar.
Yeah, exactly.
And so he was really lost in his battle because he was going for power over what's right.
Right, exactly. And because he was afraid of losing his temporal political power, he could therefore become manipulated by other people and their threats. It's really, this is beside the point, but it's really true that true freedom for a human being comes from not being invested in anything in this world. Because if I have no investment in anything in this world, nobody can threaten me with anything very threatening to me. You know, what are you going to do, kill me? That, I think I've mentioned before, one of my favorite passages is where Jesus says, don't fear those who all they can do is kill you. And after they kill you, have nothing more than they could do.
Like that's no big deal.
Like that's no big deal, yeah. He goes on, fear the one who after you have died has the authority to cast your soul into hell. That's the one to fear. And it's a whole passage about we need to fear God, not man. If we don't fear man, then we are free. Then we are truly free people. We can do what's right. We can pursue what's good. We can speak straightforwardly and forthrightly. And we don't need to be afraid, because if anyone is going to touch us, it's only by the will of God that they will touch us, and otherwise they can't even touch us anyway. But if they do, then so be it. I haven't lost anything of any eternal significance.
Yeah, because
that's real freedom.
It is. It's real freedom, because if we're not invested in, for example, power, if somebody becomes more important than us, then their importance is okay with us. It really doesn't matter. If we really don't need money, then if someone takes away our money, we haven't lost anything.
Right.
If we're not invested in having to live in this world, if dying is okay, then we haven't lost anything. And yet in saying those things, Jack, those are really big things not to be invested in.
Yeah, they are.
And that's why we lack so much freedom. It's because the reality is we are invested in those things.
You know, a lot of people will hear that and say that is just so utterly unrealistic. You know, how can we ever get there? But the fact is, that is what Jesus is teaching us, is that we really do need somehow to get there.
To be uninvested.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And it may sound unrealistic because it sounds so out of reach. It sounds so uncharacteristic of us, and it is uncharacteristic of us. But that's what sanctification is learning more and more and having it embedded in us more and more deeply that my treasure is not here on earth, it's in heaven. And when I come to that point, then I really experience freedom. It is uncharacteristic, but I don't think it's out of reach. By the Spirit of God, we can grow in that direction and become more and more disinvested in this world.
And I think, Jack, what it takes is for us to even look at the fact that we are invested first. Because I think an approach that we might have is saying, well, I'm not really invested. I'm already there. What are you talking about? It isn't that big a deal. First, the process that God must bring us through to be disinvested, if, I don't think that's a word, but in these things, is to recognize just the level of investment we have in them.
Right.
In order to have to start the work of setting them aside.
Yeah.
Okay, so should we go on with the chief priest?
To the chief priest, yeah. The thing that we see in the chief priests in this interaction that is not true of either Herod or Pilate, and it's kind of unique to the chief priests, is envy. I don't remember which gospel writer records it, but one of them records Pilate as assessing the situation and realizing that the chief priests are doing what they are doing out of envy. And that's one of the reasons that he's not real interested in crucifying Jesus, is he just realizes, hey, this is just your thing with Jesus. It's no big deal to me. I mean, whether he lives or die, I don't care. This is just your thing. You go take him and kill him. But of course, they can't lawfully do so. The Romans will not allow the Jewish officials to execute anybody. The Romans have reserved that for themselves. So that's why the chief priests come back and say, well, we can't by law do it, but he has to die under our law, so it's your thing, Pilate. You have to give the orders. But the thing that's interesting is that Pilate, who is shrewd at the very least, recognizes what is motivating them, and that is envy. Envy is motivated by the same thing that the kind of moral impurity that Pilate is, up to a point. It's rooted in false belief. It's rooted in the belief that it refuses to see clearly that the things of this present age are not really valuable, that the things that are really valuable are eternal things. Envy does not see that, refuses to see that, cannot see that, is blind to that reality. And that's at the root of where envy starts.
Again, it's what we were just talking about. It's being invested in things that God wants us to be, to not be invested in.
Right, exactly.
And they're so invested in, I guess for these people, the influence of their position. They were afraid of Jesus' influence, and maybe his influence would gain greater momentum if he was to live on. And so they were jealous of that, their power, right. Their place, their prestige.
Yeah. And just their status in public opinion generally. I mean, what we know of the chief priests is that they were not popular in the masses, in the mass population of Jerusalem and Judaism, whereas Jesus was up to this point. Not that they understood him, the masses didn't understand him, but at least they basically liked him. I mean, that's a real irony that a significant number ended up calling for his crucifixion. But Jesus had done nothing to put off the population. He had performed miracles that impressed them. He had said things that intrigued them. He had said things that they puzzled them and they thought were kind of weird. But he hadn't done anything to really anger them, or at least we don't have any clear indication that he did. He had angered the Pharisees. He had angered the leadership, the establishment. But your rank and file basic sinner in Israel seemed to be intrigued by Jesus more than anything else. But the rank and file basically hated the chief priests. Josephus records, if you remember the situation in Palestine at this time, there were two different parties within Judaism that vied for influence and allegiance. There were the Pharisees on the one hand and the Sadducees on the other hand. The Sadducees were by far in the minority. There would probably be only a few teachers who would have been the teachers of the Sadducees. There would have been a large number of teachers, rabbis, in the Pharisees. The Pharisees' source of control and power and influence was the synagogue. The synagogue was the place where the people of Israel went every week, every Sabbath day, to read the scriptures, have them commented on by a Pharisaical rabbi who taught them their faith, basically. So week in and week out, they were getting Pharisaical teaching about what their faith was and how you worship God. The Sadducees, the only students of the Sadducees were the chief priests. They were really the only people that they had any influence over. The chief priests and the kind of landed aristocracy, the really wealthy people in Israel, they would listen to the Sadducean rabbis. So there was this real gulf, this real split between the upper crust in Israel that were Sadducean in their theology, and then the rank and file Israelite who were Pharisaical in their theology. Well, one of the places that they differed is on the calendar, how they calculated the days and how they located, was this or was this not the day we celebrate Passover, for example. The Sadducees and the Pharisees would have had a different calendar. And also the way they interpreted how the priests were to perform their functions, the Pharisees had a different interpretation than the Sadducees. So the chief priests would go about on the days that the Sadducean rabbis had said, and in the way that they had said to practice it, would go about doing the ritual of the temple. The masses would come for those rituals, and the Sadducees would be doing it either on the wrong day or in the wrong way, and it just infuriated the people because they were not practicing their religion the way their rabbis had told them it needed to be practiced. So they just got to be this real built up anger and animosity on the part of the people toward the chief priests. Josephus records one time where they brought tomatoes into the temple, and when the high priest didn't do it the way they were supposed to do it, there's all these people just pelted the high priest with tomatoes. I just think that's a funny scene, but you're in the temple of God. They're having a food
tomato
fight in the temple of God.
Yeah,
that's how angry they were. That's how much they hated the chief priests and everything that they stood for, because they believed that they were really perverting their religion. You know, you can't be a chief priest and not in part be a chief priest because you want the accolades, you want the status, you want the prestige. I mean, that's part of why you want to be there. And yet, everybody in the whole nation hates you. So along comes Jesus, who's a nobody. He's a peasant, basically, or a lower middle class type person. Doesn't have any money, doesn't have any name, doesn't have any prestige, doesn't have any status. He's from Galilee, of all places. I mean, he's a real Palestinian Okie. He doesn't have any standing whatsoever. And yet the people are intrigued by him, follow him around in masses of people, go out to hear him and see him. He's the talk of the town. Everybody is talking about this man, Jesus. He performs miracles that give him a decided advantage in attracting a crowd, and their envy takes over. They'd hate him because he has
what they want.
Captured the imagination of the people, which is what they want. Exactly.
So they were already kind of fighting for it and losing ground with the Pharisees, and now this other guy comes along teaching the scriptures, and they're really losing ground again. It's
right.
Kind of like they had their fall.
Exactly, yeah. So they want him dead. I mean, they want him dead. And ultimately, their rationalization is also a very real fear, is that they are afraid that he's going to so incite the people that they're going to rebel, go to war, battle the Romans or something, and Rome is going to say, we've had enough of this, and take away, I can't remember which one now, is it Caiaphas who says, it's expedient that one man must die for the whole nation, otherwise the Romans will come and take away our position and our place. I mean, they realize that they have their position among the Jews only by the grace of Rome. And if Rome gets fed up, they're even going to take that away from them. So they see it as politically expedient that Jesus die. But it's not just that. They're also envious of this man. He has what they want, and they don't want it, so he has to die.
Okay, so let's tie that into spiritual warfare.
Before I do that, one more comment. The thing that you see in envy that's unique to envy is how utterly irrational it is. Somebody over there has what I want, and I don't have it. God has given it to them. God has not given it to me. So, you know, what would be a rational response? A rational response would be to be angry with God and to take it up with God. God, you are not giving me what I want. Now, that's bad enough, because just even my anger at God about that shows my short-sightedness and my false beliefs, my lie, and my self-centeredness. There's all kinds of things wrong even with that picture. But at least it's rational that I would take it up with God. I would blame God for not giving me what I want. But evil gets so irrational that I take it out on the person over there who has what I don't have. I hate them. It's an utterly irrational hatred. But it's so like us. It's so typical. It's so natural for us to try to hate and want to destroy and want to kill and want to hurt the person to whom God has given what I want for myself.
You know, I was just talking to my husband about that. There's a person that was in my life, early in my life, who I think I'm just beginning to realize that person was incredibly envious of me. And I couldn't ever figure out why they didn't like me, what it was that made them so angry toward me, so hurtful toward me. And I think I was looking back and thinking, you know, well, I had this and this and this. It was because I was born with some of the things that I had, and because I had a particular personality that made me appealing to some people that they wanted to be appealing to. And I don't think I was trying to take something away from that person at the time. I just happened to have the qualities that they wanted, and they set out in their life to destroy me.
Mm-hmm.
And I just am coming to the conclusion that that was it. It was a very irrational thing. It wasn't something that I was grasping. In fact, I'm just, as an adult, you know, 30 years later, recognizing, oh, I get it. I see. I had something that they wanted. I was so unaware that it was so valuable to them, but I think that's what it was, and they went around about destroying me and feeling, or trying to, and feeling very justified in doing so. And I think that's really what you're talking about here with
exactly.
the chief priest. Really wanting something that somebody else has, just on a visceral level, not cognitive, not thinking, okay, maybe this person has it because they were given it by God or because it's something good, but I want it and I'm going to destroy that person, although destroying that person doesn't give it to me.
Right, right.
It just takes the spotlight off of them, but it doesn't put the spotlight on me. It doesn't
right.
give it back to me.
Right. Yeah, I know a situation very well where a woman's older sister has hated her for her entire life for no reason except that God made them different people, and the older sister wishes that she had what the younger sister had. And the defining feature of the older sister's life for her entire life now has been to hate the younger sister.
Kind of a vendetta against her.
Yeah.
A mission against her. That's my experience with this person.
Yeah.
Probably a very similar situation.
And it's utterly irrational. But sin is always ultimately irrational. That's one thing we have to understand about sin, is that it doesn't really have to make sense. It doesn't even try to make sense. It's destructive of reason, just as it is destructive of everything else good. It's out to destroy God and everything he is and everything he stands for. It's just the very nature of evil. And so one of the things that it's destructive of is even rationality itself.
Mm-hmm.
Out to destroy just for the sake of destruction, just for the sake mm-hmm. of destroying.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was talking to somebody about this situation in my life and with another person, and they said basically just that, that in talking to this other person, they would not allow themselves to be distracted by the truth. Isn't that interesting? Think about it. That no matter what truth came their way, that I was, in fact, a person that would like to extend myself to this person that's trying to hurt me, and that I really am not intent on hurting them in their life, or never really realized why there was a problem, that they will not be taught by reality. They will not be taught by the truth. They're just out to destroy because they feel this envy that is really on an emotional level.
Mm-hmm.
I want to take, I want to hurt, and as you said, I want to vandalize. Mm-hmm. And that's what the chief priests were doing.
Yes, exactly.
They just wanted to take.
Yeah.
So before we go into my question about spiritual warfare again, I keep on pushing in there. Probably end up with two series on this now. You know, Jack, before we are too hard on the chief priests, or maybe not too hard on them, but kind of put them in a class by themselves, I'd like to enter myself into this whole scenario of envy. I've talked about somebody else being envious of me. I don't know if I've used this example on the radio before, but I remember you teaching this passage in church, talking about the envy of the chief priests, and I was thinking to myself, I don't think I'm envious of anything. I really can't think of something I'm envious of now. Wow, that's great. And then as you were going along teaching, I started thinking, I sure wish I had a mind like Jack's. I sure wish I could put things together like he does. And I realized that I was envious of you. And I am. I would really like to be able to think the way you do, to think as creatively and as systematically as you do. And I think there's a difference between being envious and wanting to hurt you with it,
mm-hmm.
or being envious and just liking that and wanting that. And I think that's a qualifier we need to put here. Because it isn't always that I'm envious to destroy somebody, but envy can easily get there.
Right. And we use envies loosely. Sometimes we use envy, and what we really mean is we really respect and admire somebody in some respect, which is not an evil thing. When we look at other people and look at the qualities that God has given them and built into them, and we appreciate it and we admire it, and then there becomes the spiritual warfare. There's the temptation. We can cross over a line where it all hinges on, are we saying to God, you made a mistake by not giving that to me? Why don't I have that? I want that. Then it becomes evil. But when it's just right there at the place of, wow, what a remarkable trait they have, what a remarkable ability they have. That's just recognizing God's handiwork for what it is and admiring it and appreciating it. That in and of itself is not evil.
And even wanting it, not in a sense of grabbing it, but saying, that would be really nice.
That would be nice, yeah.
I would really like to have that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, even that I think is innocent. As long as it doesn't cross that line over. And that's where the temptation comes in. That's where the spiritual warfare comes in. Is that voice that comes in that says, yeah, why don't you have that? Why didn't God give that to you?
How come you got left out?
Yeah, you got shortchanged, didn't you? So that we begin to look at it not as an appreciation for what somebody else has, but for what I don't have. And that shift off of them and admiring them onto myself and ways in which I have been left behind or left out or something, then that's that self-centered perspective that is the beginning of evil itself, beginning of evil and envy in an evil way.
It can go down the road to ultimately being people like the chief priests.
Yeah, murderers.
Murderous.
Yeah, exactly. So we've already kind of touched on where spiritual warfare is at. It's spiritual warfare is always at the level of ideas. False ideas, deceptions, lies.
Passions.
And getting me to look at life one way rather than another. That is the temptation, is don't look at it this way, look at it this other way. Don't look at it from this angle, take this other angle on it. And there's where a choice gets made. I either succumb to the temptation or I don't succumb to the temptation. Maybe the best way to illustrate it would be look at one of the temptations of Jesus in the wilderness. Want to go there?
Sure.
If we look at the account in Matthew, for example, in chapter 4, the second temptation is the devil took him into the holy city and had him stand on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, if you are the Son of God, well, actually, even before that, look at the first temptation. The tempter came and said to him, if you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread. But Jesus answered and said, it is written, man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Basically, what the tempter is seeking to do is to get Jesus to look at his situation one way rather than another. Here, Jesus has just been baptized by John, and a voice out of heaven has said, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. And Jesus is on the verge of beginning this significant mission that he is on, has been sent on by God. He is the Son of God, the Messiah, the Christ, the most important person in the entire universe, the one who has been destined to be the King of Kings, the King over the eternal kingdom of God when the kingdom of God is finally established one day. There is no more important creature in the entire universe, and that's who Jesus is. Well, the tempter's playing on that, because here we have Jesus, after his baptism, being led out into the wilderness for 40 days without food. He's starving to death. And the tempter's coming along and saying, okay, let's take a look at this situation. This voice came out of heaven, came and said, you are my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased, and he's starving you to death? I mean, who's responsible for that? Who led you into the wilderness, Jesus? Who controls your life? Who is the providential provider who can provide you with anything you need? Your Father, the one who said, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Interesting way to take care of his beloved Son in whom he is well pleased, isn't it? In other words, the tempter's trying to get him to shift his perspective onto focusing on what he has not been given, what he has not been provided with. And in focusing on that, then, to get a new look at, to look at God in a new way. Don't look at him as a good God. Look at him as a bad God. As a God who is pretty inept, pretty incompetent at best, and maybe downright evil and perverse and bent at worst.
Or he says he cares about you, and look at this, there's evidence that says he really doesn't care about you.
Precisely, yeah. So it's trying to get him to shift his perspective on what is reality, what is true, what is the right and proper and balanced and proportioned way to look at your life. And at that point, Jesus has a choice to make. He can choose to look at it the way the tempter is getting him to look at it, in which case he'll be prepared to do what the tempter is asking him to do. Namely, why don't you take care of yourself? Why don't you turn the stones into bread and look out for yourself? Because you really can't count on your Father to look out for you. So why don't you look out for yourself? And he can choose to do that. Or what Jesus does instead is he chooses to remind himself of the right way to look at things. He chooses to remind himself of a passage out of Scripture that that puts in perspective what's happening to him in the light of what's actually true, and to keep on looking at his life from the angle that he has been looking at it, and to not shift his perspective.
Now, Jack, to apply this to the passage on spiritual warfare. So he's saying, put on the full armor of God. We're looking at Ephesians 6:10. And I just thought this was so appropriate. It says, finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the full armor of God that you may be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil, which is exactly what Jesus is having to do.
Exactly.
So what is the armor of God? And one of them, he says in verse 14, stand firm, therefore, having girded your loins with truth. And that's exactly what Jesus is doing. He
exactly.
is girding his loins. He's remembered. He's thinking about. He's invested in the truth. That's a huge part of who he is and what his life is about. And that's what he's using to resist the schemes of the devil.
Right. And then in 16 as well, in addition to all, taking up the shield of faith with which you will be able to extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one. I think both of those are true. Having girded his loins with truth is having made that what his life is all about on the long haul generally. I mean, just in general, he's made a commitment to that, and that's crucial. But then in this particular situation, the tempter has come along and said, why don't you look at life differently here? And what does he do? I think he takes up the shield of faith in response to Satan. He says, but you see, I believe the truth, and I believe the truth against your lie. I mean, a kind of tit-for-tat specific, I believe this specific truth as opposed to your specific lie. And that's a defensive move where I'm actually countering that specific lie with a corresponding specific truth that I choose to believe against the lie that Satan wants me to believe.
And that's really juxtaposed to what happened in the garden with Adam and Eve.
Yes.
There was these flaming darts of the devil. His schemes came along and they said, okay, we'll choose to believe you, Satan, rather than choose to believe that God is a good God that wants to provide our needs. So really exactly the opposite thing happened.
Exactly, yeah.
And an observation I'd like to make about our lives is we're not like Adam and Eve or Jesus, where we have Satan directly talking to us. But the same questions are coming into our lives through all sorts of things that happen in our lives all the time. Like in this whole question of envy. Is it okay that God didn't give me the kind of prestige that maybe I want? Is it okay that God didn't give me a mind like you, Jack? Will I allow that to be okay still remember that God is a good God who gave me? Or will I believe, well, maybe God doesn't care about me. Maybe he's not a very good God because I don't have these things. And Jack, I know there are some people that is an enormous, enormous question, because it isn't, for some people, their life is so painful, their life is hurting so badly, they can hardly live. That to believe that God is a good God in those circumstances is an incredible battle. And to have to fight for the truth, to have to submit to keeping alive even, is a huge thing for them. Some people I talk to, and I'm just glad that I'm able to talk to them again. I'm glad that their voice came over the phone or that they showed up at my office, because it's one more day that they chose to live, not believe that the world is only hell and they should just commit suicide or hurt other people, but the world maybe is under the authority of God.
Mm-hmm.
And so the battle for them is enormous.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the battle for all of us is enormous on all different levels. But I guess my point here was, we don't necessarily hear the voice of Satan audibly like Jesus
right.
or Adam and Eve, but it's coming through our life experience all the time.
Yeah, and through the things that other people tell us, that our friends tell us, that our spouse tells us, that our children tell us.
Things like?
I mean, it can be any number of things, but things like, well, you need to take care of yourself. You need to look out for yourself. You need to defend yourself. You don't want to suffer in any number of ways. That can be the message. Well, you don't need to suffer. You don't want to suffer. So avoid it. Get away from it. Do what you need to do to get rid of the suffering in your life. Anything that basically comes along with take care of yourself and don't trust God with your life. Take care of yourself.
Well,
is that kind of message.
Yeah. Gosh, Jack, you're language is getting me here.
Okay.
Because there's a sense in which I think you would agree that we do need to take care of ourselves. What you're saying is don't take care of ourselves and relinquish trust in God.
Exactly.
So it could be taking care of myself might be setting limits against somebody who wants to be hurtful toward me. That would be a wise thing to do. It might be out of my fear of how people might see me if I didn't do that, that I would give in. So it's not just a really black and white thing that you're talking about here. You're making a very specific statement in regard to spiritual warfare.
Yeah, it's take care of yourself in the sense that Satan wanted Jesus to take care of himself in that temptation. Don't allow God to order your life. Don't count on him to order your life. Don't count on him to take care of you. Forsake him and go out on your own, is what I mean by take care of yourself. Go out on your own.
Forsake loving, forsake goodness, forsake what's right, forsake what you know is good, forsake truth, forsake your faith, and take care of yourself. Give up all those things.
Yeah.
That's what you mean.
Right. It can be very, very right for us to take care of ourselves, but the reason it's right is not because it's taking care of ourselves. It's right because it's right. You know, it's right because it's the right thing to do. But all too often, the voices that we hear, the counsel we get is take care of yourself. Don't worry about doing the right thing. You just need to take care of yourself.
Yeah.
That's the voice of Satan, not a friend. And I'm reminded of when Peter basically, Jesus is predicting his death and his crucifixion. And Peter says, oh no, that's not going to happen. You're not going to do that. And Jesus' response is, get behind me, Satan. You know, Peter, you're a mouthpiece for Satan at this point in saying that. This is the will of God that I go and die and be crucified. And it's not like I want to do that, so I'm vulnerable. I'm emotionally vulnerable to you sending me messages like you don't want to do that. So don't talk that way, because you're giving mouth to the will of the tempter when you do that.
Because Jesus at that point was saying, I know that suffering is the right direction to go in at this point. That's what's really good. It's not what I want, but it's a good thing.
Right.
And so, in a sense, you could say Jesus was taking care of himself.
Ultimately.
Ultimately, yeah. So that he doesn't give in to the vulnerability that he may have been feeling at that time, but taking care of himself in line with truth.
Right.
In line with goodness.
Yeah, exactly. But your point, that illustrates your point, and that is that typically we don't have Satan appear to us in a black coat and make some suggestions to me. Typically, temptation comes through movies, music, television, friends, neighbors.
Oh, my own desires. It's even closer to that.
Yeah.
It's really my own desires a lot of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And our warfare, the spiritual warfare, is to resist all those ideas that come at me from wherever they come at me that are misleading, untrue, deceptive, but really attractive and really seductive, that tug me in a direction that I'm already ready to go just because of who I am as a sinner. And they pull at me and they tug at me and they want to take me that direction. But they're not right, they're not true, and they're not good. And I need to remind myself of what's right and true and good and hold firm, hold my ground, and say, what I really want my life to be all about is obedience to God and truth. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to stay the course there.
Jack, when we're giving into spiritual warfare, lots of times it doesn't look like spiritual warfare to us. Lots of times it just looks like a matter of preference or a matter of values. I'm thinking about people who, for example, are single and they feel like they really, 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 really want to be married and they're not. It looks like that's just a preference that they have. But oftentimes it goes across the line. And of course they might have that preference. I mean, I think if I was single, I think I'd really want to be married. But there's a line that it crosses over to feeling like they've been left out. Why me, God? And I think ultimately if you go down, all the way down to the end, what they're saying is, God, you're not a good God that you didn't give this to me. I don't think that's at the level of our consciousness in the beginning, but I think that's what we're talking about here, is that even though it may not look like spiritual warfare on the surface, it might just look like we're being left out. Ultimately, the question is God a good God or a bad God for giving me this or not giving me this? And am I willing to follow him or just live in self-pity or anger or frustration or envy or a million other things because I didn't get that?
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that is really big in our culture is the whole question of abortion. And I watched a movie recently that I've mentioned here. It's called Cider House Rules. And I think I also mentioned that it is a really, truly, beautifully choreographed movie. The actors are beautiful. The scenery is absolutely luscious. It's just really lovely. But what they're doing is they're placing before us this whole question that we're talking about here today. The question is God a good God that evil would touch my life and I would have to deal with it? There is a whole argument pro-abortion. And ultimately, I think that pro-abortion, people who are pro-abortion are saying it's okay for us to take life into our own hands, to take it away, because ultimately what I don't want to have to do is suffer. God certainly wouldn't have me suffer. And I think in that understanding or in that belief about life, we're giving in to the flaming darts of the devil.
Yeah.
We're saying that God can't give that to me. I must take life into my own hands. It is a scary movie because it makes abortion look so good, look so right, look so humane.
Yeah.
They also have a very big piece about lying. And ultimately what they're saying about lying is, if it gets me what I want, if it makes my life more comfortable, if I can lie and get away with something that justifies the lie, that I believe justifies the lie, then it's okay. And ultimately what I'm saying is I can't be an honest person with integrity and follow God. What I need to do is lie, take life into my own hands in the sense that you're talking about it, take care of myself by lying because I don't trust or believe that God's going to take care of me if I'm a person of honesty, if I'm a person of integrity. It's a very scary, very awful movie in that regard.
Yeah.
We have lost the battle with spiritual warfare, I think, in the fact that we think that is a great movie.
Yeah. And the media, particularly in our culture, is one of the most dangerous mouthpieces of Satan that there is. I mean, that's where spiritual warfare happens big time, on big scale, precisely because the camera always lies, is a very, very important tool for telling lies in a way that are compelling, that really make it seem true, sound true. And yet the messages that come at us through the movies are just utterly false and misleading, dangerously misleading.
And they're dangerous because media has not just become a piece of our life, but we're immersed in it. It's like we're in the water of it. We've dove into the deep end, and we're in the deep end of this culture that is teaching us things that are not true, and yet it's surrounding us. And I really am scared for the children in our culture, or the people who aren't thinking, because it's so pervasive and it enters in so cleverly. We need to really look at what is truth. We really, really need to say, I'm going to commit myself to understanding the scripture, because if I don't, I'm in this culture that leads me in the opposite direction.
Absolutely.
And I will lose.
Yeah.
At the end of this century, the big questions about reality and being human rise with unexpected power. We ask ever more agonizingly, what does it mean to be human? How do human beings fit into this vast cosmos? Where to from here? In his News and Views article, Postmodernism, A New Model of Reality, Mackenzie Study Center member Wes Hurd shows how our present-day culture answers these questions in radically non-biblical ways. He shows how the prevalent postmodern view of life is fed to us through television, popular music, and education. However, he also states that although postmodernism has many negative aspects, it may present opportunities for biblical Christians to dialogue more openly with people who need real answers to some big questions. Call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Postmodernism, A New Model of Reality.
it has been really exciting, a really good thing for Jack and I to get together and dialogue about so many different issues with the backdrop of the Bible, trying to understand the Bible better, trying to understand how it fits into our lives in a real practical way. In addition to the radio, we've been trying to think about what are some other ways that we can dialogue with our listening audience and with other people to perhaps even expand the audience that wants to listen to what's being taught here at Christianity at Work. So we came up with the idea of offering seminars or workshops to people out there in your community. We would like to offer this for a weekend retreat, for a women's group, for your support group, for a men's group, a women's group, a home group, for your church, for schools, for colleges, just about any group that wants to get together and put together a workshop. We'd be really excited to help you out. The format that we're thinking about is an interactive one. Just as you hear on Christianity at Work, Jack and I are interacting with each other. The topic could be one of your choice. It is really wide open for us. What you want to have us present, we'd be very happy to do that. We also appreciate the dialogue between ourselves and our listening audience. We've had a couple of times where we've gone out to different communities, and that has just been a wonderful thing to get to know you, to see you, to interact with you personally, face to face. So your questions would be a big part of what we would do in any seminar. Depending on the response, we may not be able to meet everybody's needs, but we're going to try and do the best that we can. If you're interested in this, we invite you to contact McKinsey Study Center. It's at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And the telephone number is 541-485-4801. And those addresses will be, and phone number will be repeated at the end of the program. We hope to hear from you.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKinsey Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program or would like to know more about McKinsey Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKinsey Study Center or Gutenberg College. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKinsey staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKinsey staff in their ministry through their classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKinsey Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKinsey, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKinsey Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKinsey Study Center, thank you for listening.